Classic Business with Michael Avery on FMR.
Well, it's time to talk entrepreneurship here on the all-new Classic Business on Fine Music Radio, and to find out what really drives the rocket ship ticket holders, the risk takers, the dreamers and the doers to start to build and to grow businesses, and what drives them to keep going through things like load shedding and seemingly crazy odds of failure. Well, my next guest is certainly no stranger to the entrepreneurial ecosystem. He's a bit of a serial entrepreneur now. He's founder of venture builder and business incubator Aeon's Creative Technology, and former co-founder of the payment fintech turbocharged growth story Ozo. So Mitch Adams, as always, a great pleasure to have you on the show. It's been some time since we last spoke. How have you been keeping?
I've been keeping well. Thank you very much for having me on. Thank you and good day to your listeners. Keeping busy. I took a bit of a sabbatical, I would say, at the end of last year.
Yeah.
About 2 months, and most are supposed to take 3 months, but I couldn't stay away from that, actually.
Yeah, I'm not surprised. I think that it's in the entrepreneurial DNA. You understand that you need to create balance, and especially after building something like Ozo into what it is today with your partner there, Thomas Pays, good to take a break. But you've now hit the ground running again. But I want to first take listeners back who might be unfamiliar with your story, because when you think about what a software developer looks like, the chances are you thinking of some kind of maths geek lurking in the basement, typing away at a keyboard. You really are not that. You've turned this on its head because you had art in matric and then you went on to study music. What did you want to be when you were growing up?
I actually didn't get to study music. It's what I wanted to do. I really wanted to be a rapper, believe it or not. So, I've always been making beats, you know, beatboxing, writing rhymes, poetry. That's really what I wanted. My father said there is no future for that in this country. And kind of almost forced me to study. Actually didn't want to study at all. So he sent me on a Kontiki tour, which I had to pay for by way of fundraising, washing cars, and the infamous curry evenings. And once I was on this Kontiki tour, it was a 30-day tour all across Europe. And then I came back to South Africa and my perspective completely shifted. Seeing all the greenery, seeing the country, seeing the potential in it, I was like, actually, I want to do something worthwhile and meaningful here. So I just went and picked software because it seemed like a safe way to go. It's also what my best friend Lyle Edstein and also co-founder at Ozo was doing.
You went to my alma mater, which was back then, it was known as RAU, the Rand Afrikaans Universiteit, Rand Afrikaans University, now University of Johannesburg, and graduated actually at a similar time. But, you know, we were in the soft stuff. We were doing arts, and we wouldn't have really bumped into each other at that stage. But, you know, after studying to become a software engineer, what led you into the world of fintech?
So my first job was at a brokerage, a stock brokerage. And I would say that was my baptism by fire, learning all about how the JSE actually works, how money like transfers. You actually don't realize how much money's in the country based on media and what people are telling you in your communities until you see what's going on in the JSE and you actually see this money moving up and down. So, I mean, everybody wants to be financially secure, and now you're seeing an industry where the finances exist. It intrigued me, and I just wanted to be part of that. From there, I moved into a payments company, which was at that time owned by Transaction Capital.
And we know Transaction Capital, a very successful listed entity. David Hurwitz and co. have really diversified and innovated within that business, but I don't want to digress too much from your story. And that's really, I imagine, where this idea for iPay, which is now known as Ozo, was formed, wasn't it?
Yes, somewhat. So it was a payment mechanism that existed in Australia. And well, these are the days of Internet Explorer 6. That, it was basically an ActiveX plugin that you had to install, and then that drove your browser to, you know, fill in all the information for you. It was a very archaic way of doing it, but it was the way that it was done back then. As the world progressed, I mean, in my capacity at the payments company, I worked on ATMs, I worked on card payments, I worked on that system as well. And essentially a few years later, looking at what product we could take to market between Thomas Lyle and myself, we said, well, the industry's changed, or rather the world has changed. We don't have Internet Explorer 6 as our only option anymore. You have Chrome, you have Firefox, you have Safari. And not only that, our devices have moved from PCs to your mobile device.
Yeah.
And it's not just your Samsungs either. You got your iPhone users and you got your Huawei users coming out and all these different OSs. And, you know, the payment system just didn't cater for that. And no other system before that made it user-friendly at all. It offered a product for the merchants more, to help them solve the problem, but not really helping the consumer solve a problem, which was to make it the payment burden easier on them, especially something as heavy as an EFT. That's a massive burden to place onto a consumer.
And we now know that the payment system in the country is set for another modernization. The Rapid Payments Program is set to go live sometime towards the end of this year, which is also very exciting. You can pay with an email address or a cell phone number or something like that. And it's amazing how quickly the landscape is changing. Now, Ozo has been hugely successful for the three founders, I'm sure. I mean, what sort of stakes did you have in the business? What sort of operational involvement do you still have in Ozo?
At this point, I have no operational involvement anymore. You know, from time to time, I get a phone call. You know, what was the engagement with this person? Can you assist with an introduction here? And I'm always meeting people these days that want to perhaps partner with me or get me as a mentor in their payments company. So I almost see myself as a scout for acquisitions since Ozo got that injection of capital. Acquisitions and M&A play is on the cards. So I find myself as an unofficial scout for acquisitions at this point. And then I still have a small shareholding in there, which I'm very happy to hold on for the next few years as that company grows. But I've taken out the bulk of my shareholding in that. Lyle and Thomas are still very much involved.
And, you know, you I think it was almost 50 million Rand Series B that Ozo raised towards the end of last year. So it's huge.
Dollars,
exactly. And hugely successful. So, I mean, you know, you've got to times that by 16 or 17, depending on what week you're talking about. But a hugely successful venture, almost a billion Rand. And what I like about what you've done now in terms of your story in the ecosystem, and I see you're also an Endeavor entrepreneur. And it's very much part of that Endeavor ethos, isn't it? Is to be a mentor and to invest back into the ecosystem. That's really what you're doing now with Aeon. Tell me a little bit more about this incubator / accelerator that you've brought to market.
100%. So the way I actually got to this point was I found out that I am a founder at heart. I always consider myself a software developer and then a founder. But through, I think, COVID, I figured actually I'm a founder more than a software developer because I have the ability to let go, put it that way. So as a founder, you do everything and anything. Be that you're a software developer, you still have to do accounting, you still have to be the lawyer, the salesperson, the marketing person. And you do everything to the best of your abilities, and you'll reach that mark pretty soon where you can't move further with your ability. At that point, you then hire somebody that's more qualified than you to do that job. But they can't just come in and do the job. Just because they have experience and the qualification doesn't mean they can just come in. They need context. So they come in initially as someone that supports you in that role. And then over time, which shouldn't be too long, you swap positions and you act then in support of them. And then you do the very important part of giving them the authority and letting go. So I've done that throughout Ozo, moving throughout all the positions. I refer to myself as polyfiller. And the last position I filled in there was R&D, head of R&D, which I thought was the perfect and last job I would have to fulfill. But sadly, I did come to the self-realization that there are people out there that can do the job better than me. And we must give the business what it deserves. So we rather looked at hiring other people, and then I looked at what do I want to do next. Going through the Endeavor program, we've been through a few others. We've been through Edge Growth's 10x program, which I think was really great.
Yep.
We've also been through AlphaCode, and you then become alumni after, I guess, 3 years. So they will call you back to come have a mentor session with some of their guys. And I really enjoy that and love that. So I actually had a few companies speaking to me, asking me, who could we hire as a CTO here? You know, I don't think they can hire anybody. No CTO worth their salt is going to leave their cushy, secure job at the bank to come risk it all at a startup that's very mm-hmm. early stage. What you need is a founder with technical knowledge that can, as a founder, get you to a certain level and do stuff to the best of their abilities, then bring in that person. And therefore, I said, that would be me. You need a guy like me. But obviously, through that, I would need some sort of payment. I can't do OZO and that. I need to dedicate my time at some place. So that was my first thought of going on to a journey where I support startups. They cannot pay me because they don't have the money yet. So I thought, okay, we'll exchange it for shares. But if we exchange for shares, how do I keep my livelihood intact? I would have to sell shares on my side, but I can't just drive the ship all on my own. What else could I do to make this ship a bit more sustainable? And that's where I found the PE framework. And initially, and this is just me being as honest as possible, I thought BEE was all about employing non-whites and kind of just dropping or retrenching white people. It's a lot more to it than that. It's actually a whole playbook of how we can enrich the economy and actually share access to funding. And that's one of the number one problems with startups. They say they don't have access to funds. It can come through the BEE framework. Just don't think the implementation's been there this whole year.
So
not just this year.
Give me an example then of you know, if we could reimagine what this framework of BEE enables us to do in terms of supporting entrepreneurs and helping them with access to funding, which is one of those critical challenges that every entrepreneur I chat to always cites. When they're pre-revenue, access to funding very difficult. When you post-revenue, well, then every bank just wants to fall over themselves. But it's at that early stage that it can be very difficult. And also access to markets. How are you using the codes to overcome these challenges?
So there are 7 pillars to it, basically. And one of the biggest pillars, the one that costs the most points, is ESD, which is enterprise and supply development.
Right.
And that's basically saying a company should give funding to smaller companies, SMEs, where they fall in the same sector or could be set up as a supplier to that business. For instance, if you are a mine, is there somebody that makes mining tools? That's a startup right now that could in the future become a supplier for you. And that essentially, I'm going to use a generic code here, is 3% of your net annual profit after tax. So it's could be a large amount of money. In my view, the way I see it, a lot of companies see it as giving away free money. But in my view, the government could just tax a company on that and then create their own fund and you know, start dispersing the funds. But as we've seen, the government hasn't shown us that they can handle this tax money really well. And they've been getting criticism for it. So what they've said is, okay, private sector, corporate sector, you handle yourself a lot better. We're going to leave the onus of this in your hands. You disperse the funds, you get it done. So essentially, any small business could approach any corporate out there and position themselves to be a beneficiary of this funds. The problem is the big corporate guys look at these small companies and they don't feel like the money is going to be used well. They're also not geared up, the corporates themselves, to be dispersing these funds and then monitoring and managing that the money is being used in the right way. They have to focus on their businesses. Mm-hmm. That's where intermediaries step in, and that's where Aeon's acts in that way also. We identify beneficiaries, we approach the corporates, and we pair them. So the mining industry wouldn't necessarily work with a food industry or food startup unless we can find an angle for that and how it's going to benefit the community around that mine. But essentially, you want to look at transport, you want to look at energies, some sort of green technology in the mines, and you want to position businesses that speak to that mine and can actually service that mine in the future. You want to look at how many jobs it's going to create, and how it's also going to spread funds and make the economy actually work.
And, you know, bottom line, I mean, that really is the spirit of all of this. And yes, I think many have become cynical over time around BEE because it spawned all kinds of practices that were just box ticking, getting in a partner who wasn't really operationally involved in the business and just being a front, and, you know, other businesses just kind of ticking a box. But when you look at the spirit of what we're trying to, or what the drafters of the legislation were trying to do, is to ensure that we can massively transform the South African economy into one that's more dynamic, vibrant, supports small businesses, opens up supply chains, and transfers skills and know-how. Now, no one could be against that. And I think what I like about the model is that what you've identified is how to help corporate South Africa really be better at this. And what better way than to help match with local startups and scale-ups potentially. How do you bridge that other side of the equation then? So how are you going in and doing the due diligence on these potential startups to plug into your network that I'm sure you're developing into the corporate sector?
Yeah, so we basically take a VC approach there, venture capitalist approach, where we will be looking for startups, and then we do our due diligence. So it's early stage startups we in particular look at, because that is actually where the money making aspect is, if I can put it like that. The earlier you get into a company, the later you exit, the more money you can make. But I've identified a gap between what's happening with current incubators and VCs out there and where we are now. The entry criteria is a bit too high for companies. So they would say the company needs to be running for 2 to 3 years and you need annual revenue of about 2 million rand. And some of these companies are not there yet. Now, for a few years, there have been companies that were there. But now I feel a gap has been created. So all the new startups have not been getting the funding or the mentorship to get to the point where they are running for 2 years. If you look at the stats, 50% of companies fail, well, new companies, SMEs, they fail within that first 2 years.
Yep.
So if you're only looking at companies that are older than 2 years or 3 years, you're losing half of them already. And that means the 50% they got through are actually going to be successful, inevitably going to be successful. So you're just backing winners, and we're not actually creating new opportunities and new companies. It was all great and fun games, I think, over the last few years. Now that gap's been created and the pipeline's dried up. So where are these successful startups coming from? That's the gap we're trying to plug here by going for the early stage startups, sitting with them, mentoring them. Our program's 3 years. So it gets them over that 2 year mark and then sets them up for investment in year three. And then we pass them on to the guys that have the high criteria as well. And we can actually just partner with Corporate South Africa in growing these guys. They're going to create more jobs. They're going to create more market opportunities. You know, we talk about, you know, cashiers, for instance. I want to get rid of cashiers because there are technologies coming out that makes it a cashierless checkout, basically. It's all automated, and now you're going to lose jobs. The honest truth is those guys, they deserve more than that kind of job. They're humans, they can think for themselves, they have common sense, and they can do a much better job than that. That's what these SMEs are creating. They're creating new opportunities for these people to move into. My grandmother herself, she sold coffee bags as a job. That was a job for many years. I don't know anybody that sells coffee bean bags. Did I say coffee bags or coffee bean bags?
Yeah.
Coffee bean bags, nobody does that as a career choice anymore because it's been automated, and you don't find people holding up picket signs saying you stole our jobs. Mm. It's just the cycle of things and how things go. Something becomes automated, and then you have to upskill yourself to take on the new economy that comes with that.
And with that, also the opportunities. Mitch, we're going to have to leave it there. I think it's a fantastic idea that certainly its time has come in this current environment. Aeon's Creative Technology, you're listening to the co-founder there, Mitch Adams, talking about how he's using this to help corporate South Africa just be better at BBBEE and also to incubate and scale local startups to become scalable, sustainable businesses. So they're looking for startups who are producing some revenue and hopefully can get to an average of 500,000 rand a month over the next 12 months. If that's you, then get hold of Mitch Adams. You've been listening to the Entrepreneurship feature here on Classic Business.
Classic Business with Michael Avery on FMR.